This episode of The Tome is brought to you by RPGNow.com, your leading source of PDF game products from adventures to new rules to printable dungeon tiles. Find more third-party products here than anywhere else on the web. And listeners like you, thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store.
VorpalNetwork.com.
Hey, this is Mike Merles, lead developer of 4th Edition, and you're listening to The Tome.
Welcome to The Tome, episode 116. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, I'm hosting a Dungeon Master's Guide to Interview Extravaganza. This episode was actually quite a lot of work to put together, so I hope you enjoy it. It's most important to know that I've worked hard with a whole team of bloggers and podcasters who've shared preview material and toiled together to bring you the best possible DMG2 coverage we could possibly give you. So, be sure to visit thetomeshow.com to find links in the show notes to Fistful of Comics and Games, Icosahedrophilia, Dungeon Mastering, Geek Dad, At Will, and Critical Hits, all of which participated in this, and thank you to them for doing so. But in this episode, I am talking to Mike Merles, who has been working in the world of D&D for some time and can take a lot of responsibility for 4th edition being the game that it is. His name may not appear on the cover of the book that we're talking about, but he was one of the designers on the book and seemed to have more than one finger in just about everything going on at Wizards of the Coast. Beyond that, he's also the host of the official D&D podcast and an all-around great guy who knows a heck of a lot about D&D 4th edition. Joining him is James Wyatt, whose name is on the cover of the book and also has a hand in just about every D&D book that WotC puts out. Also an all-around fun guy to talk to, as well as being one of the primary writers in the world of Eberron and somebody who's been around Dungeons & Dragons for a really long time. I also had the chance to run down to my local game store, All Fun and Games, in Apex, North Carolina, to find out about the worldwide D&D Game Day for the release of Dungeon Master's Guide 2. So, let's head to the interview and see what James and Mike have to say about DMG 2, right after we break to talk about our sponsor. That's right, my favorite game retailer is still supporting the Vorpal Network, and I sincerely appreciate it. That's why I make it a point to try and tell you about a great product you can get from RPGNow.com every episode, so you can start to understand just how much variety of games they have to offer. And the things I tell you about are specifically geared toward the D&D audience. But if you play pretty much anything else, they'll have something there for you as well, I'm almost certain. In any case, my pick for this episode is the Himmelvale Streets and Sewers 3D Terrain from WorldWorks Games. It's a new take on printable PDF game tiles that can be folded up and placed in a modular fashion to create the city streets or sewer tunnels that you need. You can have a sniper crawling on the top of a building, firing down on the party, and when they duck inside that very building for cover, you simply lift off the roof, and there's a fully featured 3D model of the interior ready to play. No stopping to set up a new map or tiles, and the quality of these products really helps your players fully immerse into the game. You can check it out now at RPGNow.com.
Get the newest releases at RPG Now. Only at RPG Now can you get the absolute latest and best releases from fantastic publishers like Palladium Books and White Wolf Publishing. There are new products every single day. Come to RPGNow.com and get them the instant they're available.
So I am here today with James Wyatt and Mike Merles from Wizards of the Coast. And today we're going to talk a little bit about the Dungeon Master's Guide 2, which recently came out. And first of all, I want to welcome both of you gentlemen back on the show. It's for James, it's been a couple of months since we've talked to you. And Mike, I think it was origins of 2008 since we've talked to you. So welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
So we're talking about Dungeon Master's Guide 2 today. What is the purpose? What is Dungeon Master's Guide 2 all about?
Fundamentally, it's about giving the DM more of all the goodness that he or she needs to run the game. There's more of the sort of generically useful advice that we put in Dungeon Master's Guide 1, more traps and terrain and templates and other tea things, more kind of campaign starting material in the form of the City of Sigil that appears in this book as a home base for a Paragon tier campaign, more storytelling advice, just more stuff.
Yeah, and it's kind of built assuming that you've had 4th edition for a year now, maybe your game is getting to be around 10th level based on how, you know, the typical sort of speed that people progress. So it's really, I mean, it's a sequel almost in the strictest sense of the word, if it builds on what came before. You know, it's really just a continuation of, okay, you've mastered that, the stuff in the first book, here's sort of the next level of things to play with.
Okay, so you mentioned, I guess James mentioned that the book has a lot of advice in it, and that's been my experience with it as well. How much is this advice specifically tailored to be meaningful to somebody who's playing D&D as opposed to just somebody running a fantasy role-playing game?
There's definitely some of both. The first chapter, for example, is called Group Storytelling, and Robin Laws wrote most of that chapter basically describing techniques that he uses in his D&D game to empower the players to participate in the storytelling aspects of the campaign. And that's stuff that you could easily transport into any rules system. It's a very rules-light chapter. The next chapter is about encounter design, and I won't say it swings the pendulum all the way to the other extreme, because there's a lot of that you could use in any kind of game. But it's a lot more D&D focused on the assumptions of encounter design in 4th edition specifically, and how to tailor encounters for your group, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's basically a mix of, I mean, if you think of it, what makes the DMG different from any other D&D book is it's sort of, it has a lot more in the way of what I think of as just soft advice of just how to run an entertaining game, because so much of what a DM does is system independent. It's just coming up with a good story. It's just coming up with good hooks for the characters or good ideas for encounters. So I'd say, like, if you aren't playing D&D, there's a fair amount of stuff in here that would prove interesting. But we definitely also want to give DMs new tools, like the sort of companion characters and mechanical advice, very crunchy advice on monster creation. So it's definitely a balancing act. I think that's really just the nature of the book, of it being a DMG.
Sure. And you gave a lot of advice in the original DMG, sort of talking about how to be a dungeon master. Once you've learned how to be a dungeon master, is there much more that you need to build on, or is it just sort of how to take your game to the next level? And give some examples of how that works.
So looking at chapter one specifically, that chapter kind of leads off with an admission that it's not necessarily for everybody. It is specifically for the dungeon master who really wants to take the idea of cooperative storytelling to the next level. Giving you techniques that you can use. If you want to do more than what the sort of standard assumption of a D&D campaign is. I don't know how much that addresses your question.
Sure.
In a way, I mean, you could teach someone, anyone, you could pull some guy off the street and teach him all the rules of D&D and have him run a game in a very mechanical, almost board game-like manner. Mm-hmm. But really what makes D&D D&D and what makes an RPG interesting is when a DM goes beyond just adjudicating the rules and then building a world to really creating something interesting happening in the parts that aren't necessarily mechanics in the game. I remember as a kid, you know, when I was running D&D in high school, having that realization of, hey, I have this dungeon, but I can have, it's not just the players going from room to room finding people. I was running the Temple of Elemental Evil, the first edition adventure, and realizing, hey, I can have these factions in the dungeon using the characters as a tool against each other. So it's not just kicking in the door and killing the monster. It's kicking in the door and the monster says, hey, I'll pay you 1,000 gold pieces to go down the hallway and kill this other guy instead of me. And the players reacting to that and building off of that and getting that sort of, you know, really like a story going in the sense of the players are sort of, you know, there's more narrative base than just fighting everything you meet.
When you asked the question, one of the things you said is, you know, once you've taught somebody how to be a dungeon master, and the thing is that I don't think that's a process that really ends.
Sure.
You know, I've written large parts of two Dungeon Master's guides now, and I still think I have a lot to learn about how to be a Dungeon Master. It's definitely an ongoing process, and I think that this book is in some ways a recognition of that, that there's always more to learn.
Sure. And, I mean, I've been a Dungeon Master for 20 years, and I look through the book, and it has bits of inspiration, you know, for somebody who's been doing it for 20 years that makes me think, oh, yeah, I forgot about that, or I forgot to pay attention to that, you know?
Yeah, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Now,
it's funny, I mean...
Go ahead.
It's one of the interesting things about D&D, that you can be a DM for 20 years, and there aren't too many things out there that you can do for 20 years where you can't go take a course on it, or mm-hmm. you know, or you don't have a shelf of books in the bookstore that are just about how to do it better. I mean, we're kind of unique in the sense that for RPGs, there really isn't this big sort of canon, like the canon of Western lit, of how to do this well. It really is kind of still the Wild West in terms of advice and techniques and the sort of recognized ways of doing things.
Sure. Now, when I originally talked to Mike back in Origins of 2008, one of the things we discussed was the original DMG's approach to skill challenges, and how maybe it didn't come out the way it was intended. And there's a whole section in DMG 2 on skill challenges. Does that address a lot of your concerns in that area?
Yeah, it's really... I mean, I think one of the best things that this chapter does is just gives a lot of examples of how to run a skill challenge. Because I think what one of the mistakes we made in the first DMG was sort of leaving people hanging in terms of really meaty, deep examples to show them like what makes a good skill challenge as opposed to what could be a skill challenge. Because mm-hmm. I think one of the things people struggle with is this idea of like, look, you can make a successful skill check, but that doesn't end the skill challenge. You know, so you have things like, and I may have used an example elsewhere, but you know, the skill challenge to bribe the guard to let you pass the gate. Well, if the first thing the players do is give the guard a sack of 100 gold pieces and make a diplomacy check, how do you keep that scene going without it being absurd, right? I mean, right. The guy just took the bribe. You're done. You know, it was just a skill check. And I think that's really what this chapter kind of addresses, is really giving more of a structure to skill challenges, how to build up options, how to think bigger picture. You know, because I think people said, hey, skill challenges, that's how I do my non-combat encounters in the game. And there would be things like bribing the guard that aren't really encounters. They're just a skill check. And so I think that's one of the things this chapter does. And it draws on a part of the chapter is drawn from a series of articles that are up on the website that really just sort of gets into, here are a lot of the guidelines for how to justify turning something into a skill challenge.
How much responsibility for a skill challenge do you think should be, in terms of building it and making something into a skill challenge, how much of that is the DM and how much of that is the players need to drive that?
Yeah, I think it's both, but I think a good skill challenge sets up the players to succeed in the sense of becoming engaged with it. You know, and so I think that's one of the really big things when you're DMing a skill challenge or designing one, is finding a way for the players to just naturally want to become engaged with the scene. You know, and that's part of that is just, you know, allowing for a lot of variety of options. The other side of that is creating a narrative for the skill challenge that makes sense. So you don't have that feeling of, here's a skill challenge of climbing the cliff and everyone just keep making athletics checks till you succeed. You know, there is a sense of change that the skill challenge is a bit more dynamic, that there's a little more going on than just you're just hitting the same button over and over again.
Okay. And you mentioned before that sometimes you're bribing the guard and you give him the sack of money and make your diplomacy check, and it's absurd to turn that, you know, to make, try to draw that out into a whole skill challenge sometimes. Is there a reason that skill challenges have to have a certain number of successes or failures? Can an advanced DM maybe take it and just let the story or challenge grow and change organically?
Yeah, and I think that's definitely, and that's one of the hardest things. I think that's definitely true. And I think, I personally run skill challenges where I didn't write down the skills beforehand. I just had a general sense of what the players wanted to do. And, you know, if they're trying to sneak up on a tower, I just know, well, here's who's in the tower and here's what's going to happen based on what the PCs do. and just kind of keep in mind the sort of, well, once they've hit this successes, they're going to be in the tower and they've snuck in. If they hit this many failures, that's when the guards come, you know, charging out of the tower to find out who's moving around in the bushes outside. And I think that's definitely, in a way, that's one of the hardest things of designing for an RPG, is at times you just want to kind of tell the DM, look, be creative and be interesting and be dynamic. But a lot of that ties into sort of, let's say, like the advice in Chapter 1, where if you are thinking and really engaging being an active DM, that might just flow naturally from you. And I think that's just where having good DMing skills makes your entire game as a DM better.
So was the skill challenge section your baby in this book, Mike?
I wrote parts of it. It was kind of a collaborative effort because we pulled examples from different sources. We basically just kind of went through the past year or so of skill challenges and pulled out the most interesting ones to show off as examples.
Polished them up a little bit.
Yeah, and Rob Donahue, a freelance designer who works with us, did a fair amount of work on the section. And part of it is drawn from sort of the advice I've been writing online. So it's...
I was the one who took it and stitched it all together.
Yeah.
Okay. So this book also has a chapter that includes a lot of new options in terms of rewarding players. We already have treasure and magic items and experience points that brings in new powers and new feats and all this other stuff. What do you mean by optional or new rewards for players?
What this chapter, it's actually the chapter is Chapter 5 Adventures, but this section on alternative rewards focuses on three kinds of rewards that serve the same game function as magic items, but don't serve the same world function or story function. They're not physical items. They might be a blessing that a god grants you because you've purged her altar of corruption, or
which my character did in James's game.
Yes, or a benefit that you get because you've slain a mighty dragon and bathed in its blood, or a benefit you get because you've sought out a great master and trained with him for some period of time. So they work more or less just like magic items, in that they have a property or power that is limited in use per day or whatever, but they're not physical items and they don't fit into the economy necessarily in exactly the same way.
And I found it interesting that you found some of that sort of design space basically in the magic item mechanics. Was there ever a point when you were working on this concept that there were completely different mechanics for that? Or was it always sort of a different version of magic items?
Yeah, I mean, really, it was the kind of thing that pretty early on, I think that the concept started off in one way, but it was pretty clear that it was best suited to sort of occupy the same bucket as magic items. That we really, if we want to do something different, we'd be reinventing the wheel. Because at the end of the day, it really were, the initial concepts of them story-wise looked a lot like magic items. It was just, I think it was kind of embracing, like, look, the really interesting thing here isn't that it's a new mechanic per se, but it's a new story element. That what should be exciting about this is, like I said in James's campaign, my character earned one of these by cleansing a temple of Ayun that had been overrun by evil. And that makes that item, even though my character sheet kind of has the same space as an item, it feels very different to my character in how I roleplay it and how it feels my character's background. And I think that's what we really want to emphasize, not that they were just novel mechanics for the sake of new mechanics.
Sure. So moving into a different area, there's also a lot of advice in here on how to set up encounters and how to set up, how to make your monsters more interesting and that kind of thing. Now, compared to older editions, I find monster creation in general to be a lot easier in 4th edition, especially with things like the D&D Insider Monster Builder. So is it really necessary to have all of these options in terms of templates, or can I just make a new monster?
You can absolutely make a new monster, but I'm actually really excited about the themes that we introduce in this this chapter in this book that give you some concrete ways to either take existing monsters and modify them or create entirely new monsters, but that all have some common themes, really, a common flavor to them. Again, it gets back to that, you know, what is the story of this adventure thing, where if I want to do an adventure that revolves around cultists of far realm entities, then I can turn to the theme on the, where is it, the those who hear, that has all these attack and utility powers with a Far Realm influence flavor. And if I stick those on a bunch of monsters or people in an adventure that I'm running, that flavor pervades the whole experience for the players.
Yeah, in a way, the themes in particular, like, kind of take a step in the direction of kind of showing you how maybe we internally design monsters, in the sense of if we're working on a monster manual and doing some new orcs, we definitely kind of have this internal concept of this is what is an orcish power, and this is what is more of a goblin-y power. And so this kind of gives the DM those tools of here are a number of powers with a tight theme to them that you can use to kind of create your own sort of tribes of monsters. And really, actually, the genesis for it came, the mechanical idea came from my own Greyhawk campaign. I use this evil god in Greyhawk, he's one of the big villains of the setting. And I gave all his priests this power where, when James got his character to see this firsthand, where the priest would create an illusory duplicate of himself, turn invisible, and teleport away.
Hate that.
And if someone hits the illusion, it turns into poisonous gas. And it was very nice narrative-wise, and also monster design-wise, to have that as a linking power between all these clerics. Because now whenever the players find a cleric of values, they get nervous as he's getting beaten up. Well, okay, everyone, start making perception checks, because did this guy just leave an illusion, a decoy behind, that's going to create another poison, a cloud of poison that we have to deal with. So it's really creating that theme of going, hey, that's a cleric of values. This is what this guy's trick is.
So the concept of building these thematic monsters or encounters can basically be accomplished by taking some monsters that may or may not have anything to do with each other, but you apply templates to them so that they mesh together well. Is that sort of sum that up well?
Yeah.
It's like mechanically they mesh together well, and then story wise the players can go, hey, it's those who hear because look, the leader has an aura of madness, and then the players understand what that means. You know, it basically links the narrative with the mechanics in a way that encourages sort of group building, like you just said.
Okay. Well, it's interesting because one of the early criticisms, I guess, of 4th edition is that there wasn't a lot of mechanics to support storytelling. And it seems to me that as more and more product comes out, like the DMG2, you have more of that mechanical support that brings in the storytelling. Was that one of the goals?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Definitely, yes. I mean, it's something that, because part of it too is with the first DMG, we're assuming there's also a number of people who've never played D&D before who've been picking up that book. And this is kind of, if that's like the DMing 101, this is kind of like the grad level course, I guess I'd say,
the advanced seminar.
Yeah, exactly. Professor James Wyatt in session.
Excuse me while I stroke my goatee.
He does.
So when you work on things like this and you're trying to do some of that, how much of that is you knew ahead of time that that was something that would be needed, and how much of that is reaction to some of the things that have been said by the community?
It's both. I mean, when I think about like the group storytelling chapter, that's a case where I've been reading Robin Laws's blog on LiveJournal regularly, and I was really excited to read about the stuff that he was doing in his D&D campaign. Clearly he wasn't listening to the people who say that 4th edition doesn't allow role-playing, because he was doing a heck of a lot of it, and I wanted to bring that to a wider audience, so I asked him to write that chapter. Very early on, we recognized that the skill challenges chapter was going to need bolstering.
Yeah.
but then a lot of it was just, okay, we're going to do DMG2 now. What goes in it, and what are the best ideas we can come up with that will fit in this book?
And a lot of those ideas come from the campaigns we run.
Yeah.
Like, I know especially a lot of stuff I directly worked on springs directly from the themes are a great example, like the Cleric of Values, where that is a tool I used all the time in my campaigns to make NPCs, to link them, to unify groups of creatures in ways that was compelling, to give the players those, kind of like the danger they learn to expect. And yeah, and a lot of that stuff comes from the games we run.
It's even just, I'm looking at a spread now in Chapter 2 called Creating Movement, and which is directly coming out of a number of experiences that I've had in Bill Slavisek's Thursday Night game. Gosh, we roll initiative and roll terrible initiative, so we end up having the fight in the doorway. Let's talk to the DM about how to avoid that. Gosh, our archer ranger never moves, rarely even enters a room until the fight is over. What are some ways that the DM can move around that or encourage the monsters to take cover or that sort of thing? So Yeah, we play the game a lot. I'm in 4 campaigns and running one now. And that's my creative fuel, I guess, for what needs to show up in the game.
It's kind of like what we said about before with DMing, that you can do it for 20 years if you still have things to learn. And I think game design, working on D&D, is the same way.
Yeah.
Whether it's either just listening to what people are saying, watching people run their events. I love reading people's campaign journals online just to see what they're doing, and from our own campaigns.
Sure. And James, you said you're involved in, what, 5 different games? Is that on a weekly basis then?
No. Let's see. One of them is 2 times a week at lunchtime. That's the game that Mike is running.
My Greyhawk game.
One is every week on Thursday evenings, although I've been on a leave of absence from that campaign because I'm doing a play right now. Mm-hmm. And then the other two are monthly, or one of them we sometimes play twice a month. And I forgot the game I'm running is a lunchtime game where we play about 3 times a month.
Okay. And then how many games are you involved in, Mike?
See, I run my Greyhawk game at work. I have a Planescape-inspired / City of Brass campaign I run on Mondays. It's a very high-level game. And then I play in James's game.
Okay, so...
Slacker.
So, but you're involved in, I mean, within work and outside of work, you're involved in both running and playing the game pretty heavily, so that you're very familiar with the issues of being a DM or being a player.
Yeah, and that's definitely part of it. I mean, that's a big part of it is, unless you play the game, I mean, I've always felt this even back, you know, ever since I started writing for RPGs like 10 years ago now, players can figure out when you're writing from the position of ignorance of just, you know, I'm writing, I maybe, you know, whatever role-playing game I might be designing for, reading it versus playing it versus running it are very different experiences. Mm-hmm. And I think that definitely shows in the utility of what you're offering. You know, it might not be, you know, doing something like the themes might not seem obvious until you've said, hey, I want to run an adventure for the Cult of Orcus. That's the kind of, you know, the shtick, the next 3 or 4 levels, you're fighting the cultists, and I really want these guys to all feel like they're tied together. So the players know when the monster does X or when the priest pulls out this holy symbol and casts a spell, oh, it's the Cult of Orcus. We hate those guys.
It's kind of like the saying about how you should never trust a skinny cook, mm-hmm. that you should trust a game designer who isn't playing the game that he or she is designing for.
You bet. Now, getting back into a bit more of the content of the book, you add a lot in terms of more... I guess there's a pretty lengthy discussion in terms of terrain. And this idea of terrain powers and different things that terrain might do in your game and how to use it for, like you were talking about before, encouraging mobility within the encounter and that kind of thing. At what point in time is it too much?
That's a really good question. And I think my rule of thumb is if I'm putting together an encounter area, I like to have 1 or 2 things that are really terrain-wise are very active. You know, or my other fallback too is, especially like the terrain powers example, if the players initiate something, like I had a player once, they're fighting in this room, this monster jumps on top of the table, and the player says, I want to flip the table over and send this guy falling on his head. And I essentially use the design guidelines here to adjudicate that. So the way I see the players want to do something interesting, I'm all for that. But as a DM, I try not to overwhelm the players, because I think there is a point at which, you know, you're explaining 8,000 things at once, and really from a design side, everything just gets muddled. You know, I think it's preferable to have 1 or 2 very vivid things than 8 ones that aren't necessarily leaping out at you.
Yeah, and I have to say, I was particularly inspired by the terrain powers concept, you know, the idea of having that environment that is, you know, fully destructible or usable in an encounter is really interesting. But now I'm going to have to go back and retrain my players to let them know all of that stuff is usable. Do it. Be creative and bring it into your encounter.
I ran an encounter a couple months ago now, I guess, where I had the idea that these pillars on the map would have the power that, you know, if you grabbed onto them, you could have a burst of energy out from them. And the monsters used it against the PCs, and the PCs never grokked that they could turn around and do the same thing. So I need to find ways to communicate that better, I guess, or make it more obvious.
Yeah. And I think if you notice, if you look at the terrain powers in the book, a lot of them do ongoing effects. They have effects on a miss. And those are ways, they seem subtle, but those are ways you can really encourage the players to use those. If, for example, the ruined wall example, if the players don't want to use a daily power, but they want to really hit a guy hard, well, you know, most encounter and at will powers don't do anything on a miss. So these are pretty easy, pretty simple mechanical hooks you can put in there that make the players go, hey, that's better than my power in some way, without it being, well, we just spent the entire game just trying to knock walls over on people.
Sure, and it helps combat the 5-minute workday concept as well, because now they have more interesting things to do without expending that resource.
Exactly.
Now, you also have a section dealing with, traps and in bringing more traps into the game, or more examples of traps. What does, other than a list of new traps, what does the DMG2 bring to the realm of traps?
It offers guidelines for designing traps, which is something we couldn't shoehorn into the first DMG. And then basically just more advice. There's two top 10 lists, traps to avoid and ways to make your traps more fun, that I think are full of fun insight into what the role of traps in the game is.
And I also was happy to see just that real subtle little bit with each of the new traps sort of on the tactics of a good way to use that trap.
Yeah.
I thought was very useful.
Yeah, it's almost like almost more like a monster in the sense of showing you a little bit more of how to use that within the context of an encounter, mm-hmm. instead of just getting stats.
And ways to combine them with monsters as well.
Sure.
Which I like.
Now, the first DMG didn't really focus on a single tier. I mean, there were some things that did. But DMG2 does have a Paragon tier focus. So talk a little bit about what the purpose of that section is.
Well, it kind of grew out of the last chapter of both books, that the first DMG presented the town of Fallcrest and the surrounding Mentir Vale as a starting campaign environment, pretty well focused in the heroic tier. And we decided very early on that DMG2 should give a similar treatment to an area that could be a home base or a campaign area for Paragon level characters once they've kind of moved out and beyond from Fallcrest and its environs. So that's why we included Sigil in here as the gateway to a Paragon tier campaign that focuses on planar travel, or includes a lot of it anyway. And from there, it was just kind of a logical outgrowth to also, hey, let's spend some time talking about what happens. As Mike said earlier, you know, once you've been playing for the game for a year, we figure you're probably hitting these levels, and let's give some concrete down-to-earth advice about what happens to your game when characters get up there and how you can start to think about the risks and rewards and threats, challenges as the game changes at that tier.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is just kind of giving people the framework for the campaign and how it might shift. I know, like, right now I'm running a high-level game, and just by setting the game in the City of Brass, it has a much, much more different feel. You know, the players aren't just dealing with the local mayor and maybe the Thieves Guild. They're dealing with, you know, Imix, the evil prince of elemental fire. They're dealing with the Afridi lords who rule the city. They're dealing with, you know, the Cinder Lords, these pirates I created who sail the Sea of Fire. You know, it gives the game a different flavor. I mean, you could find analogs for all those guys in the heroic tier of just like, well, they're just pirates. It's just the noblemen. But just drawing on sort of D&D lore and the history of the game, it's such a different feel if you're dealing with an Ifriti as opposed to a dwarf.
So, in what ways, I guess, could you summarize? What things should a DM be looking for if they want their Paragon tier game to really sing, to be really good? Is it all about traveling to the planes?
I think planar travel is part of it, but I think the bigger picture thing for me especially is showing the players that they are now powerful. They're not just, you know, these kind of treasure, I mean, they can still be treasure hunters and all that stuff, but they go from dealing with, the way I like to see it, they go from dealing with guys who I've made up, that it's just like, here's, you know, Lord Winston, the local mayor, to, oh, it's Imix. The players, as veteran D&D players, know who Imix is. And that, just on its own, carries a much greater dramatic weight. The players sort of realize, hey, we're real movers and shakers in this world now. you know, we might be doing similar acts. They're still adventuring, they're still fighting monsters and stuff, but it takes on a grander tone. It's much more, and I don't want to use the word epic because it's epic here, but everything feels a little bit larger, the stakes are a bit higher.
Yeah, I think stakes, consequences is a big thing for me, that not only is it, you know, we're powerful, we're important, but the things we do matter, they carry weight, and if we screw up, the consequences are much larger than what's going to happen to us or our village. It could be the fate of the world, really, in our hands. That high stakes is a big part of it for me.
Okay, and DMG2 has lots of advice sort of to help a DM build that kind of story?
Yeah, it's got stuff on... I mean, one of the things I really like about the book are the campaign arcs that Robin wrote up, mm-hmm. where there are sort of basically taking you through... different stories, you know, sort of different campaign arcs you can write about in your game, almost like adventure paths, and really showing how you can start small, get bigger, and then get really grand at epic tier. And I think those illustrate really, I think this is kind of a principle where it's far easier to illustrate, just to show someone, here's how it changes, rather than kind of just try to describe it.
Sure.
You know, and there's plenty of advice, but I think one of the things I really like about the book are, I really like reading those back when I first got the drafts in JA, you know, and I was working on my portions of the book.
Now, a lot of people worked on this book, and so I was curious if either one of you or both of you maybe could search around in your brain a little bit and maybe share a story of inspiration or a story from the process of working on this book that maybe even some of the other designers haven't heard yet, something that might surprise them.
This one was a little bit different than our usual books because there was a lot of freelancers working on it, and then I worked on it, and then James worked on it. There wasn't much that we did concurrently.
Yeah, the process was weird. This is something that all of the freelancers have heard, actually, very, very recently, because I just sent them all an email saying, our DMG2 process was a little messed up, and the reason for that is that it happened in the time period when I had just been promoted from lead story designer to design manager, and Mike had moved from being the lead developer to being the lead designer. So we were both transitioning jobs, and both working on trying to lead the book together. And as a result, neither of us really had time. fortunately, time was made for me later on to take the pieces that everybody had written and pull them together into a coherent book that I think turned out okay, despite the process and thanks to the time that was put into my schedule to give to it. So that's kind of the sausage factory, here's how your food is made thing that is maybe not so appealing. It was a year ago now that we were working on the book. It is hard to think of specific, perhaps more entertaining stories.
Maybe it was a matter of providence in the whole thing. But even though you were both sort of new into the position and trying to figure out how to make it work together, a lot of the early rumblings I've been hearing about the book have been almost exclusively positive. So something came together well, it looks like.
We also have very good writers. I think the freelancers, you know, we had Robin Laws is great. It's really a team effort. And I think that's really for our end, for me, it was more just learning how to put a book together and trying to keep everything organized because it really was the first time I had done it at Wizards and on this scale. Development is a much more... you get the book, and then you go through and develop the mechanics instead of you start with nothing and make a book. And it had been quite a while since I had done that.
Sure.
So it was a learning process, but I think we have good people to fall back on, you know, that when we work with here and as our freelancers that I think really, really made the book sing.
And it looks like you had some freelancers that were new that you hadn't worked with that much in the past in this book, and I think it was refreshing to get in some new voices as well.
That was a cool thing that we were able to do, is we picked out two folks who write RPG blogs, as a matter of fact, John Four from RollTips.com and Yax from DungeonMastering.com, and got them to write sections of the book. So they each contributed some material, some of which is attributed with their names in it, and others of which is just folded into the running text. But yeah, that was very cool.
I want to thank you both for being on the show again, and hopefully we get a chance to talk to you in the future.
Yeah,
thanks. Our pleasure. Thanks.
Yep. And now, let's head over to All Fun and Games for Worldwide D&D Game Day for DMG2. And talk to Vivian, the owner of the store, a little bit about why she likes hosting and organizing these events at her establishment.
Okay, I am here today with Vivian from All Fun and Games, and let's start off by asking, what's All Fun and Games all about? Tell us a little bit about the store.
It's basically your one-stop shop for unplugged gaming. And when I talk about unplugged gaming, that means no video games. It's all board games, miniature games, hobby games, RPGs, and the accessories that go along with that. And a host of the events that we schedule go along with those activities. So.
And it is located in Apex, North Carolina, which is in the Raleigh-Durham, Chapel Hill sort of area. Yeah,
that's correct.
And so today you are hosting the DMG2 Worldwide Game Day release event, because the name's not quite long enough.
Yes.
But
they make it longer every time.
Right.
So.
So tell us, why is it that All Fun and Games likes to participate in these sort of events? I've lived in the area for a little more than a year, and it seems like every time there's an event, you guys try to participate.
First of all, it helps grow the community, and for us, we want an environment where people enjoy spending time at our store. So the more activities that we can do, the more time people actually get to spend with us, and for us, that's what makes the difference between, I think, hopefully us and them. So.
Great. And so what specifically have you seen in terms of the DMG2 release, and how is it sold, and has it brought people into the store?
Actually, with the DMG2 release, it actually sold a lot better than I initially had thought. My pre-orders, I didn't have a lot of pre-orders, so I kind of kept my particular numbers low, and then I actually had to do a quick reorder before the actual weekend event. So it did a lot better than I was expecting to, just because there are so many more players versus DMs. I just wasn't sure that was going to be the thing to do. So,
have you seen an increase in business on the game day events? You know, do people come in and play and then also pick up some books while they're here?
Yes, they generally do. And my store specifically generally runs specials during that time period. Mm-hmm. So we'll probably do something today for the gamers that are here for participation. So.
Okay, great. And what kind of support do you get from the, you know, Wizards of the Coast or whoever else is sponsoring these sort of events?
Well, generally, they provide all the adventures and the miniatures and stuff. Overall, a lot of times, if they send any promos, we tend to give those things away. Our store specifically, I think, does a lot of self-support because of the community growth. But WotC, they do a lot of advertising for us, and they send people our way, so we do what we can to keep going.
And is there any promotional material for today's event?
Yeah, I think we're doing a special on power cards, where we're going to be giving away a bunch of power cards today.
Very cool. And is the DMG2 event today different in some way than the previous? I mean, there's been several worldwide D&D game days at this point. How does this one distinguish itself?
I think, in general, they're not necessarily trying to distinguish themselves, but just making it an ongoing activity that all players know no matter what. Anytime there's a big release like that, they'll have something to do and somewhere to go to kind of geek out with everybody else. So.
Great.
Next, I talked to Rob, who is playing at the game day event and having a blast doing it. He's going to tell us why he likes to attend the game days.
Rob, who's playing at Worldwide D&D Game Day for DMG2, the infinitely long-named event. And he's been setting up an adventure for another group, and we'll chat with him a little bit about the experience. So what is it about these Worldwide D&D Game Day events that sort of brings you out, brings you to the game store?
The best thing about these events, normally we play at home or we come up here and play during the week. This brings a whole new, I guess you would say, the type of person interested in the game. Normally, whether we role play or whether we play it as a strategy game or we play it as no matter what reasons we play it, all types come out on today, and it's fun seeing them and the roles they play in the different with the different characters.
Okay. And one of the things that's unique about this event compared to others is that you're getting to play a hand in actually designing the adventure that another group is going to play. What about that? Is that make the whole thing more interesting, or is it you'd rather have more time to play and not have to worry about DMing and all that kind of stuff?
I'm normally a DM, but it's so awesome today the way people, we're all getting together, we're creating an adventure. That adventure is going to go to another table. They're going to play the adventure we created, and it's interesting to see the different plot lines that people come up with at the table. It's so hilarious, and I just, even if you don't play role-playing games or you don't, you know, you don't play these type of games, you should still just try it, because I think you'll have an awesome time. It's really fun.
And have you had a chance to look at the new DMG2 yet?
I've read half of it. I bought it the day it came out, and the thing I love about the DMG2, a lot of the things in the DMG2, I think they should have put in the DMG1, because it tells you little things you wouldn't know about dungeon mastering a game, like where to seat certain types of players, how their playing style will help the person next to them, bring that person into a more, you know, exciting part of the game. And I think, yeah, it's great. The monster creation and the player ideas that you can give your players when they're at the table.
So, and so do you see a definite connection between the DMG2 and the event today? I mean, can you take some of the things you read in DMG2 and be using it as you're constructing the adventure for this other table?
Oh, definitely. I'm using it right now when we're sitting at the table and we're coming up with ideas and how the monsters are going to be put, or we say monsters, but it's really just people in an encounter that you're going to experience during that encounter. I think that reading the DMG2 helped me a lot in making sure that it makes sense. You know, that it's going to give them a proper challenge, I guess. I don't know if that makes sense.
Sure. So tell us just a little bit about what sort of sneaky and conniving things are you putting into your encounter, your adventure here, that you're going to pass off to another group to have to deal with?
All sneaky and conniving things.
like any good DM.
Let's see. Since they're not going to be able to hear this interview in time, we're going to put, one of the things we're going to do is they have swarms, what they call swarms, which are, these swarms hide in gold coins, and we're going to put the gold coins in a pit, and of course everybody in D&D loves gold, so they're going to look through the gold coins, and that's when we're going to spring it on them. But, and that's just one of the small things, but really the main thing is story. You don't want to have surprises overcome the story and the fun. The fun is where it's all at.
Good. All right. So, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was fun. And finally, I talked to Nathan, who's a regular volunteer at RPGA events, including this one, and also runs the local dndmeetup.com group, which is responsible for me finding my current game group. Let's hear why Nathan works so hard to make these RPGA events go off without a hitch.
Okay, so now I am here with Nathan. At All Fun and Games, the worldwide D&D Game Day event for the DMG 2 release. And he has helped run logistics, I guess, for some of the things going on here for this event as a volunteer. And so tell us a little bit about this event. What's it about, and why is this unique?
This is DMG 2 Game Day, so it's the first time that players have been given the chance to ride an adventure. And we just started writing it, and it's kind of hilarious. So,
do any mothers get killed in the process?
This adventure we're designing is very heavy on mother death. There's a summoning ritual that the ritual component is mother's blood.
And, interesting.
Yes.
Well, that's a good player motivator, which ties into some of the things in the DMG too.
That was the hook that we went with, and it should be a good motivator, yeah. Good.
So tell us a little bit about running these sorts of events or organizing these events. You know, what kind of players come out? What kind of, you know, do you see a lot of new people to the game learning about D&D for the first time or learning about RPGA for the first time or any of that?
We have a wide range of players. Today, I believe we had two new players to RPGA. New DCI numbers were given out. The majority of the players are returning players who've played Living Forgotten Realms and other RPGA events. And then you've got, you know, people who only come out for game days.
So. And so what kind of support is there from Wizards, you know, to get DMs in there and to get players in there? What kind of bonuses or rewards do people get for participating in these events?
Everybody gets to keep their miniature for their character. There's some extra minis for the monsters, and sometimes we give those out. There's maps and the instruction booklet. I'm sure somebody will keep that as as a prize, and the DMG2. It's a good resource.
Oh, it's a good resource. That's good.
It's
that'd be a
support.
Pretty big prize.
Yeah, it's support.
All right, all right, all right. Good. So what events are coming up in the future that people should be looking out for?
Worldwide D&D, or Weekend of the Realms on Halloween weekend.
Is it Halloween?
It's the last weekend in October.
Okay.
So it's next month. And Player's Handbook 3.
Is that coming out in a few months now?
Yeah, and that'll be interesting because I think they're spotlighting a few new classes, the key power source and the shadow power source.
Very good. So any last thoughts you have on the Worldwide D&D Game Day for DMG2 that you think people ought to hear about that might motivate them to get out there and participate in other RPGA events?
Well, it's going to be quite an interesting combat because players designed it, and our adventure's of course going to be full of mother killing. So.
is the process of designing the adventures going as smoothly as the plan was? Because this is the first time that's really been done.
It is taking a little bit longer than I thought it would, and but people are having fun.
Good. All right, well, that's episode 116 with Mike Merles, James Wyatt, and the crew at All Fun and Games for the DMG2 Game Day in Apex, North Carolina. I want to thank all the interviewees for agreeing to come on the show, as well as the crew at Porter Novelli for arranging things with James and Mike, and All Fun and Games for agreeing to let me run around and pester them during the game day. I wanted to take a moment to tell you a sad story of one of the owners of All Fun and Games, Bobby, who recently died of a melanoma, leaving behind a husband and son. She left the world too early at the age of 38 and is missed by the local gaming community. I wanted to encourage all of you to consider looking into your budget and your hearts to see if you have any funds available to donate to the Melanoma Research Foundation in memory of Bobby. Find a link in the show notes for how to do this. Okay, so we're almost done here. Just remember to email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com. Review the show on iTunes or tell people about it. That really helps get out the word, bring in new listeners, and increase my numbers, which gives me more access to being able to get into more of these great interviews and more events. And the more I can brag about how many people listen to the show, the more powerful the show is and the more we can pull off. And also don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store if you don't have a local game store that you love, for products discussed on this show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds and it helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. And this has been episode 116, DMG2 Interview
Extravaganza
of
I'm on the wall.